Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Imagine a world in which the excess energy from one business would be used to power another. A world in which environmentally sound products and processes could be more cost-effective than wasteful ones. A world in which corporations partner with environmental and social justice organizations to ensure better stewardship of the earth and development of societies all over the world. Okay, now stop imagining. That world is already emerging. As Peter Senge and his co-authors reveal in The Necessary Revolution, companies around the world are boldly leading the change from dead-end business-as-usual tactics to transformative strategies that are essential for creating a flourishing, sustainable world. Peter Senge is senior lecturer at MIT and the founding chair of the Society of Organizational Learning. He was named as one of the 24 people who had the greatest influence on business strategy over the last 100 years by the Journal of Business Strategy. Peter, welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave.
Peter, what is the business rationale for sustainability?
The business rationale depends on where the business is at. It's most common that most businesses start to get into this territory for one of two reasons. Either something really bad happened and they're trying to react, like an exposé about their use of child labor in the third world, or they start to realize that there's a lot of waste in their operations. Reducing energy usually saves money. It also reduces waste. So typically the starting case for most businesses is some combination of these two. They're either trying to make sure they look like they're a responsible citizen. I don't mean that to sound too cynical, but it often is just about that. But usually it starts to really get into the business when people start to realize that leaning the business isn't just about labor costs. It's really about all costs. And there's a lot of costs tied up in our waste streams, material waste, energy waste. And oftentimes there's a pretty good short-term business case. You eliminate or reduce those wastes, you reduce costs. It's the starter. It often, for many companies, becomes the ending, too, because they don't go much further. It's like that old saw in the quality movement. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit, but oftentimes after the low-hanging fruit, people don't go any further. And that's happening today with a lot of companies in sustainability.
So how do you really demonstrate to the world, and certainly to your employees, that you're serious about sustainability?
Like anything in the business world, the people who work in an organization want to see things in the day-to-day reality in which they live. So they see some fancy sustainability report coming out of the corporate headquarters, but they turn around and look at all the junk going into the trash bin, and they just shrug their shoulders and say, well, here we go again. Another big corporate program. It has no impact on me. It always starts with things that really people can look and see the day-to-day effects. If you're talking about a manufacturing operation, my experience is frontline workers know a lot about the waste. But do you ask them? If you go out and say, I notice we're running this equipment in a suboptimal way. We don't maintain it. We don't do good preventive maintenance. And the result of that is we're very inefficient and we waste a lot of electricity and the machines are breaking down all the time. People in the front line know this. And you want sustainability to seem real to people, you go right at something that's in the immediacy of their experience.
Okay, I have a question that not many people talk about, and that is collaborating across borders about sustainability. People have written about how to build a case for change, but how do you go about collaborating across borders?
The borders can be internal or external. We all know that most organizations are tremendously fragmented and processes internal across all kinds of borders, and people have great difficulty collaborating across those borders. But increasingly, for a lot of the really big issues, water, energy, waste and toxicity, you really have to work across organizational borders. So, for example, you're talking about the partners in a value chain actually operating as partners as opposed to transactional relationships where everybody is just kind of gaming everybody else to get the lowest cost. You're not going to significantly rethink your value chain if that's the quality of your relationship. Increasingly also for the really difficult problems, and that's in essence what all this is about. It's about problems that aren't getting solved. Water is the most acute problem in the world today. There are some places even in the United States where people are well aware of that, like the Southeast and the Southwest. But in other places of the world, it's a horrific problem today. No company can do anything about that by themselves. Coca-Cola last year announced a global effort to promote integrated watershed management around the world. Now, they did that in part because of a five-year partnership with WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, and they're pretty knowledgeable now about the areas where there is acute water shortage, which not coincidentally often tend to be the areas they want to grow their business. But they're not going to grow their business if people more and more are concerned about how many people do not have access to reliable, clean drinking water. Sugar added to the water is going to seem like a luxury that's quite secondary.
Peter, you talk in your book about a shared commitment. How do you build a kind of shared commitment? You just talked about Coca-Cola. How do two companies come together and work to address an issue of the environment?
First, it has to be important. It has to be something that has moved from being just a problem that we expect somebody else to fix to something that we feel like we've got to address ourselves. But even more so, to the degree the collaboration is challenging, the problem better be really important, or nobody's going to have the patience, the perseverance to build that relationship. So I used the example a minute ago about Coca-Cola and water. It took 5 years for the company to kind of wake up. And I don't think they're necessarily far behind others. I think they're probably as far ahead as anybody. Because by and large, you're running a business, you don't think about these things. You know, you're worried about the water in your plant. If you're a good company, you don't want to waste water in your plant. That's a bad thing to do. But nobody thought about the quality of water in the larger watershed or community in which they were operating. And no one quite knew why it was significant until there was a big expose in the Delhi Times a few years ago claiming that Coca-Cola and the other soft drink manufacturers in India were using an extraordinary percentage of India's drinking water and had bought up rights for a huge percentage. Now, it turned out the expose was written by some guy sitting at his computer in California, an Indian gentleman. It was full of erroneous facts, so Coke's immediate response was to defend itself. They finally figured out that that was actually not the right response, because although the facts were wrong, the perception was quite valid. If you have a country with hundreds of millions of dehydrated people, selling a lot more Coca-Cola may seem like a pretty low social priority. And that's when they started to realize that they either had to be a real leader in managing water sustainably, or they would be really vulnerable. It became a strategic issue. And what I mean by strategic is the future of the company. If we don't start to see changes in how water is managed around the world, it could have a huge adverse impact on the future of the company. At that point, your board and your chairman and your CEO start to get really concerned. So I'm saying all this because building these kind of partnerships like Coke has with WWF is obviously not easy. These are totally different organizations, come from totally different backgrounds. You know, you got a bunch of scientists on the one hand and engineers and marketing people on the other. They don't relate to each other very well until there's something that really compels them. The availability of drinking water in much of the world and the increasing stress really started to compel them on both sides, by the way, because the WWF people, they're not predisposed to work with a bunch of Coca-Cola people. Why would we do that? You know, we're scientists trying to protect habitat, but you can't protect habitat if you have a business system that's basically extracting resources at a rate which can't possibly be sustained.
How do you sell it then? That's really a cost issue, isn't it?
Not really. I don't think it's just a cost issue. You could say in some cases it's a risk and cost issue, but if that's the way it's sold, you'll get at best a kind of moderate, essentially a protective kind of commitment. We've got to protect ourselves, which is good, and that often will get a board concerned. I actually think the far more powerful case, and again, this is situation by situation, so this is not always going to happen very quickly for a lot of companies, is when people start to see a really significant new opportunity. Maybe a good example of this would be what happened with Nike, because there you can see the whole range. 15 years ago, a little less, Nike got hammered because of child labor in its Asian manufacturers. Truth of the matter is, there probably weren't more than a dozen people in Nike who even knew that was going on. They've never manufactured anything in their life. They outsource all production, always have. They're a design and marketing company. That's the essence of their strength. So again, initially, defend. Well, we're not the only one. Those same plants, you know, they're making Adidas on Monday and Nike on Tuesday and Reebok on Wednesday. It's not our fault. It's everybody. Well, that only gets you so far, because they started to realize their brand was really at risk. Because Nike is the natural one for the activists to single out. They're the best known. It took about 3 or 4 years before they started to realize it was much different situation than just defending and protecting. And they started to realize that there was a huge upside opportunity in becoming a leader. And a leader in what? A leader in eliminating waste and toxicity from their products, which they are today. A leader in labor relations, that rather than trying to defend yourself, you look at the opportunity. Nike now has an internal rating system, which is probably the most sophisticated or as sophisticated as any in the world, for rating all products on embedded water, energy, waste, and toxicity. And internal competitions going on inside the organization to see what products get rated highest. And why are they doing this? One, it's enormously exciting for the people in the company. But these are designers. You give them a challenge. There is a new shoe that you will hear about in the next month or two. It'll be the new Michael Jordan. They call it the 23 shoe. Every few years, Michael Jordan comes out with the new, this is the basketball shoe that is the best in the world. This shoe has no glues. It's stitched together, which means almost no waste in production. It can be disassembled and completely recycled. It's virtually a totally green shoe. Michael Jordan didn't know what that meant, but all of a sudden he's getting all this great PR, and the bloggers are going crazy about Michael Jordan's new green basketball shoe, which, by the way, is also beautiful. That's the upside. So Nike is gradually positioning themselves as being a world leader on the creation of products of the sort that we should have, which means products that never end up in a landfill, products that don't generate waste, that don't have toxins embedded in them, that aren't going to make the workers producing them sick. And at the end of their lifetime, they can be completely recycled, or if they go into a landfill, they're completely benign. It'll be another 5 years probably before that perception is fully present in the brand image, but that's where they're going. And that's not just defend themselves.
So that's what you mean by redesigning the future.
Exactly.
What if you don't know the solution to the problem?
Oh, you never know the solution to the problem. The only problems you know the solution to are the trivial ones. We're talking about reinventing commerce here. Even companies that have really made some progress, if you ask them, they'll say, well, maybe we're 5 or 10% of the way. All of these issues, food, water, energy, waste, toxicity, they were, for all intents and purposes, off the strategic radar screen of every company, really. If you ask people at Nike today how many pounds of CO2 they generate, a lot of them will answer. They know. Who knew that 5 years ago? The Nike Air shoe, one of their first big success stories, that was a hugely successful product. The only small problem was the gas that they had to put into it, called SF6, was a terrible greenhouse gas, actually worse than CO2. They discovered that about 8 years ago. Now, no one ever thought about this, but a few companies are really pretty knowledgeable about just how acute the climate change problem actually is. Public is just starting to wake up. Next few years, there'll be a lot of wake up. They spent over $100 million, some say internally a few hundred million dollars, 5 years of research to try to figure out how the heck to replace that gas. They couldn't find an answer. They finally found a way to create a membrane so that all that's inside the air shoe is air, so that it actually wouldn't leak out.
If you approach sustainability by going first for the low-hanging fruit, does that better prepare the company to think strategically?
Generally speaking, it does. When BP first made its declaration, they were the leader in the oil industry. 1997, the CEO, Chairman John Brown, gives a speech and says, we're going to hit the Kyoto targets as a company in 10 years. They actually hit it in 3 years, which meant that they had to reduce their global emissions by about 20% at that time. He didn't have a clue how to do it. But he used that. He sent a letter out to the 300 top managers in the company and said, okay, I've now made a public commitment. We need to go to work. We need your ideas. They sent the missive out to thousands of people throughout the company. They found all kinds of stuff that people could do. Oil companies for years have flared. Basically, they dig a hole and they have excess gas that comes out. They can't sell the gas. They burn the gas. It's a terrible source of CO2 in the atmosphere. Nobody actually likes doing this, but it's a common practice in the industry. They suddenly realized that's a heck of a lot of CO2 we're releasing. Why don't we just stop flaring? And they did. That idea came from the field. So if you engage people in finding these low-hanging fruit, you accomplish two things. One is you start to eliminate a lot of waste, but two is you start to get people thinking, wow, what could we do next? And that builds momentum.
And ultimately, they become strategies. They grow.
I think so. There's two ways to think about strategy. The kind of standard business school model, which we've been brainwashing kids with for decades, is, you know, the board and the chairman, they sit around, they think big thoughts. I've never believed that very much. There is a responsibility of boards and CEOs and chairmen, and it's the articulation. But oftentimes, the key strategic ideas, they bubble up from an organization. You might say almost the definition of a well-managed organization is you've got people throughout the organization engaged in all kinds of significant innovations, many of which have real strategic implications. And the good executives are listening all the time. Bob Galvin once said it well at Motorola. He said, my job as the chairman is to listen to what the organization is trying to say and then make sure it's forcefully articulated. So I think the idea that strategy is a top-down process has always been a misleading simplification. So when you engage people throughout an organization around these issues, then they start asking questions like, well, why do we make that product in the first place? That's really a stupid product. We could have a much better product. Would have one-tenth the waste if we designed it that way from the beginning. But then at some point, of course, you have to make investments. And those investments might be in new technology and new processes. And at that point, obviously, it becomes a strategic investment decision. But I think it's always a two-way process.
Peter, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
The name of the book is The Necessary Revolution, and we've been speaking to one of the authors, Peter Senge. As always, we'd love to get your feedback. So please drop us an email at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. For more information on our executive conference centers and seminars, please visit our website, www.amanet.org. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.